morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And today we're presenting you with An All Is in the Family.
All in the Family, or It's a Family Affair, depending on how you describe
exactly.
It. Three very different business organizations in three very different parts of the food and beverage world, but all fascinating in their own way because of their family story.
Yeah, I mean, it's not all that easy working sometimes with family members, but these people have managed to do it very successfully.
And we're not interviewing Barry and Audrey Sterling of Iron Horse Vineyards today because their daughter Joy runs the business, and you'll find out that she wasn't exactly a volunteer to do that when she was asked to take it over, but the family has done a tremendous job.
So is Joy
with their Green Valley Vineyard. And you'll enjoy the story of how it all began and all the cuvées they've developed, and most recently the exciting replanting of the vineyard that's been going on, and some other stuff that Joy's up to as well. So here's Joy. I want to welcome to On the Menu in today's program to Joy Sterling of Iron Horse Vineyards in Green Valley, California. Joy, welcome to On the Menu.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure.
And you've been up to all kinds of exciting things since we last talked when we were out at your wonderful property and we had lunch with the wonderful Barry and Audrey. And how are they doing? Are they doing well?
They're just wonderful. My father, Barry Sterling, turned 84 in October.
Did he really? God bless
him. And my mother's birthday is coming up in May. I won't dare tell you her age.
No,
she'll be so mad at me if I do.
You mustn't do that. And these are two of the most interesting people on this whole planet. Even if they didn't produce 10 different cuvées of champagne, which they do. and which we drank every one of them at lunch with them. But they are just such wonderful, educated, interesting people.
Well, the first smartest thing I ever did in my life was pick my parents.
You did well. and you had another incredible landmark in your own personal career when Governor Moonbeam asked you to join a rather prestigious committee. Tell us a little bit about that before we get carried away talking about sparkling wine.
This is the most thrilling new chapter in my life, that the governor appointed me in July to the California State Food and Agriculture Board. And it is just we meet once a month. Every meeting is an incredible education. And as you can imagine, the work of this board is so important, unfortunately, in light of the severe drought that we're experiencing.
Which is supposed to be even longer term than anybody predicted.
I'm afraid so. I think we need to, we of course have a forecast for rain next week, and we're all hoping that it'll be plentiful. But I think my big takeaway from the meetings throughout 2013 and at the start of this year is that we need to address the long-term problems. We can't think of it like a leaky roof, so to speak.
Yeah, you have to really fundamentally rethink everything to do with the conflicting uses of water in your state, right?
Yes, and the biggest thing is that we need to work together. We need to realize that we are all in this together, that the environmental concerns, the farming concerns, the cities, the developers, all of us, we just simply cannot fight. We must work together, and so that we're not having the same conversation over and over and over again every time a drought comes around.
But to put it lightheartedly, we could all make a contribution by drinking wine, not water.
You bet. Drink bubbly, not water.
And that brings us back to really the subject of this conversation, which is yet more development of your wonderful portfolio of wines. But for those people who don't know anything at all about Ionis, have never heard of it before, start us off with the elevator speech, and then we'll go from there.
Thank you. Iron Horse is my family's winery, and we are located in Green Valley, which lies entirely within the Russian River Valley. It's the coolest, foggiest part of the Russian River Valley. We pertain to the little town of Sebastopol, which is equidistant between Santa Rosa and Bodega Bay. We are a completely estate-bottled winery, and Iron Horse is our home. We have three generations living here, from just turned 19 to recently turned 84. We grow only our own grapes, of course, as I mentioned, estate-bottled. We're best known for our sparkling wines, and the pillar of our prestige is that we are now on our fifth consecutive presidential administration to serve Iron Horse at the White House, which began in 1985 with the historic Reagan-Gorbachev summit meeting.
Right.
And that was the Russian. And that was the Russian cuvée, right?
That's what we call Russian cuvée. And as you can imagine, my family takes complete credit for ending the Cold War.
and so they should. Entirely appropriate. They should do that. And but when we were out visiting you, and I guess it's probably got to be at least 5 or 6 years ago.
At least
we saw something really dramatic and unexpected as we drove up to the vineyard. The road, the area off to the right, going down the hill, was naked. And complete the story there, because I know that you grubbed it all up, even though it meant a huge investment, but you wanted to make sure that you were prepared for the next several decades or centuries. But explain to our listeners who don't perhaps quite understand what a major change, what a major effort that represented for you.
Well, we, since 2005, have now replanted 80 out of 160 acres of vineyard. And it has been a breathtaking endeavor, managed by my brother, Lawrence, who has done a fabulous job. One of the things that he and I both have learned is that a reason why the wine world is generational is that it turns out that a vine's prime is somewhere between 30 and 40 years. So each generation has the privilege of replanting, which was something I'm not sure was really pointed out to me in the fine print when I joined the winery.
Yeah, you haven't always worked for the family business, right?
No, I joined. It's unbelievable, but next year will be my 30th anniversary.
Yeah. Oh, but I remember you said when we asked you, how did you become president of Iron Horse Vineyards, and you said, I wasn't quick enough.
Right. Exactly.
I was last up the starting block, so they gave me the ugly job. But you've done it well, and you're introducing somebody new into management, I think was part of the message that you sent us.
My niece, whose birthday is today, her name is Barry. She's named after her grandfather, so my father spells it with a Y, and she is Barry I.E. And thank God we're a family business, and I don't have to worry about HR, because I call her sweetheart, baby doll, little Barry, cutie pie. You know, I mean, I would go to human resources hell if we were in a corporate world. And she is just fabulous. She is spending her time in the vineyard and in sales. And I did catch her sitting in my chair the other day at my desk. And I suggested that was a bit premature. But
well, you know, I mean, the reason that we called on you right at this particular time is you had so much in development with your vineyards in that newsletter you send out. I didn't even know how I could just post a quick update on it, because it's like totally revolutionized everything you're doing. You have even improved the quality of your already highly rated bubblies. And tell us about that.
Well, one thing that when the vineyards were originally planted in 1970 and 71, you can imagine the viticultural knowledge we have today is light years ahead. The decisions when the vineyards were planted were so basic. Everything to the east of the creek was Chardonnay. Everything to the west of the creek was Pinot Noir. The width between the vineyard rows were just tractor width. There was no concept of clonal selection. So our knowledge is so high. And as a result, the quality, the flavors, the increased complexity in the flavors that we're getting out of the grapes, naturally, pushes the winemaking to higher levels. So you begin with this gorgeous vineyard, which speaks to the incredible vision of my parents when they bought the place in the 70s. And now you add this fabulous knowledge that we have. And it's just taken us not just one notch up, but two or three notches up.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so thrilling. This has got to be the most dynamic time in the history of the winery.
And you're all having such a good time, too. I mean, tell us about Earth Day. I thought that was a riot.
Oh, my gosh. Well, this year's Earth Day is going to be just spectacular. So the date is that our event is being held is Sunday, April 27th. It's the Sunday after Real Earth Day.
Oh, okay.
Our speaker is Sandra Day O'Connor.
Right.
And which has got to be fascinating to begin with.
Oh, sure.
And have our fellow Green Valley wineries here. There will be 9 Green Valley wineries showing our spring releases of Chardonnays and Pinot Noirs. One of Sonoma's best chefs, Douglas Keene, is preparing food.
Oh, yeah. Now, where's he cooking these? I heard that his restaurant in Healdsburg closed, right?
His restaurant in Healdsburg closed. He still has Healdsburg Bar and Grill, but Cyrus, the one he was most famous for.
That's it, right.
Cyrus.
Is closed, but he just won the Bravo Top Chef Master.
Exactly.
And that'll just be great. For entertainment, this is a hoot.
I love this.
We got an all-female mariachi band from Los Angeles. They were recently featured on NPR, and the girls wear the traditional costumes with, you know, the black pants with the little coins down the side, but with bright red high-heeled shoes. I can't wait for that.
I bet you're going to get in the same uniform.
Well, I just might. And then we're going to have an environmental art exhibit curated by the director of the Museum of the National Women in the Arts Museum in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, I know it well. I taught a course on dryer lint there.
Oh, my goodness.
It was pretty funny.
But I bet.
That's another time, another story, Joy.
And then I just hooked up with a group called Silicon Valley Robotics.
Oh.
And they are going to present a display of aerial drones and ground robots.
Jeez.
That are involved in farming, the environment, and water-saving efforts.
We may have to go out there for that, right?
Well, the trouble is we have to be in London on the 28th.
Oh, okay.
So we can't do that.
Shoot.
Yeah, I know. Well, it's only the world's top 50 restaurant awards. So,
I know, but it's the classic. Why can't we be in two places at once?
Exactly.
Well, and the answer is, you can theoretically, because you can be seen in a different place, but physically, unfortunately, unless you divide your body into two, you really can't make it. Now, you sit something by there. In talking about the wines that were going to be served at Earth Day, because as I understand it, you're now not just making sparkling wines, you're now emphasizing the grapes which go into the different cuvées.
Well, few people realize that we actually started making still wine before we made sparkling wine.
Okay. You said that when you about talking about the plantings, the one side of the river was, and on the other side of the river was the Pinot, right?
But what has happened is that with this new viticultural knowledge, Green Valley is the heart of Pinot Noir country in Sonoma because we have the most sought-after soil type. It's called gold-rich soil.
Wow.
And it is a sandy clay loam that is the remnants of an ancient seabed from 5 million years ago that tilted and drained into the Pacific, leaving behind this sandy soil bed.
Wow.
You go down 18 inches, you can still find fossilized shells.
Jeez.
But what makes it unique is the elemental balance. All of the minerals are naturally, inherently harmonious, and that leads directly to higher quality. As I say, it's the most sought-after soil type for Pinot Noir. And with the new rootstock and the clonal selection, we are focusing on these small little blocks to make individual single vineyard within the estate bottlings of Pinot Noir.
Oh, great.
They are so delicious.
They are so delicious.
Now, we're at one end of the spectrum of what we think Pinot Noir is all about. First tip is you can look right through it. Mm-hmm. So we think Pinot Noir is supposed to be a light, silky, elegant, restrained wine. And what I love about what we're producing now is you get this unbelievable complexity and depth of character, and yet the weight and texture of the wine is still so light and silky, it just glides across the palate.
It's funny. I can remember several months ago we did an interview with Willamette Valley Vines in Oregon, and we talked to the winemaker, and I said Pinot Noir is very deceptive because it can look like it's really thin, as you're describing it. It can look very clear and very light-looking, or at the same time, it can be very dark, and it will taste very similar to that. So he said, I can make my wine darker if I want to. I know how to do that, but I choose not to, and I think you must have chosen to do the same thing.
Yes, I think there's a. I think on Pinot Noir in the New World, I think we have there's an array of philosophies. Of course, one of the things I love is if you line up 12 winemakers and ask one question, you're going to get at least 13 opinions.
Right. Yes, yes.
But we are a cool climate vineyard, and so we feel that our style of Pinot Noir really expresses that characteristic.
That's great. Well, we have to figure out how to get some of that. It's probably not very much of it out there, right?
Well, you know, you have an inn at the winery.
So. We do, okay. And that's the best way for people to make sure that they can get their hands on the wines they're interested in.
Absolutely. The website is fantastic, and this is the new world of wine that it's all available.
Right. Now, what's the website?
IronHorseVineyards.com.
Okay.
Good. Of course, we prefer, our favorite is for people to come taste with us.
Yes, you have a nice
Because
taste
what's so
setup.
Great about it is you remember from being here, our tasting room, first of all, is outdoors with this stunning view all the way across Sonoma to Mount St. Helena. And the vineyards are spilling out at your feet. So you're holding that glass of Pinot Noir, and you can see exactly where the wine is coming from.
Yeah, I loved that experience.
Well, that was great. But one of our favorite treats of all time was sitting in the garden with Audrey and Barry.
And
eating lunch. And I'm guessing that that's a special treat that most people don't get. Except
no, you, I'm
except,
afraid. I'm afraid that's a private, personal experience.
but you probably do that from time to time. And I hope the next time you see them, you'll remember us to them and tell them we still remember what wonderful conversation and food and wine we enjoyed on that day.
Well, I can tell you what they're going to say to me. They're going to say, well, then when are they coming back?
Well, and the answer is we owe it to ourselves to come to California. We have old friends who you probably know, Dusky
oh,
Estes and John Stewart,
yeah.
who moved even closer to you than they were before.
I know, they are the best.
Yep.
And we were supposed to go and see them last year shortly after they opened their new restaurant, and we never made it, so we'll have to make sure we make it this time.
It's the restaurant, Zazu, is the new location is wonderful. One of my favorite gifts is to give people their bacon club.
Oh, right.
Oh, my gosh. It is such a treat to get bacon every month from them.
Oh, yes.
I would need it more frequently than that, I'm afraid.
This has been a real joy, actually.
Oh, sweet. Thank you so much.
We must let you go back and tend those vines. I'm sure you do it yourself all the time.
Well, my brother does. He actually loves to prune. He finds it incredibly gratifying, so...
So you don't have to do that.
Well, exactly.
Good luck with continuing developments, continuing success, and I hope you make progress on this new commission that you're on and that you get all the parties resolute for future.
And we're praying for rain for California.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Okay, cheers.
Thanks,
Joy. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And don't go away, because we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Next stop, still keeping it all in the family, is Sanford D'Amato, and he says we could call him Sandy. And I guess we can, but his book is called Good Stock. It's a memoir with recipes.
And it has something like a slow broil on it as well in the title.
Simmer, life is
life on a slow simmer. I got news for your listeners. This man does not live life on a low simmer by any stretch of the imagination. And it's a fascinating life story that's still going on, because he and his wife didn't exactly retire. They just set off to start a farm. After years in the restaurant business, and in the years before the restaurant that he and his wife owned and ran in Milwaukee, it was in the family as a grocery store for two generations. So a charming story, a fascinating man. I'm sure you'll be very, very interested.
Sanford D'Amato, you have such a reputation. People really appreciate the level of professionalism that you've brought to the whole area of dining, cooking, chefing, restaurant management. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
So, but you've now moved on to a different area. You've written your book, Good Stock, subtitled Life on a Low Simmer, which I liked a lot. And it's a memoir with recipes. But you're really doing this in preparation for the next phase of your life is you and your wonderful wife. She sounds just divine. She could be my best friend if she lived here. and you're starting a farm, again, Good Stock Farm, and a cooking school, Good Stock. You keep going in fresh directions all the time. But you a lot of experience now. Some people do memoirs, but you really started at the beginning. You started with when you were in your crib.
Right. Well, the memoir goes from 1950 to 1996, which was about the sixth year that at Sanford, a restaurant in Milwaukee was open. And there's such a connection between where the story started in my crib above the grocery store.
That your grandparents started.
Right.
And your father.
And then my father, then my father took over, and that eventually became Sanford Restaurant. And so there's always been that connection with the building and the story and the neighborhood where we were brought up. Because my two early mentors were my mother, who was in the apartment right above, and then my grandfather, who was right next door.
Uh-huh. That sounds like a typical story, yes. Tell us, you started out, I think this is kind of ironic, I don't know, maybe it's just my quirky mind, but you start out describing how you burned your hands badly on a hot radiator and then somehow connected that into a career on hot stoves cooking.
Well, that was very early on. My parents set my crib up, and it was right in the front window because that's where all the sun came in, but it was right in front of the radiator. And so they didn't know. I wasn't walking at that time, and I could barely even get myself up. So I did get myself up one day, and I guess they were in the other room, and I was looking towards the sun and put my hands on the radiator. And it was such a – radiators were so hot. The time that my hands just got kind of puffed up, like the second degree burn. And I was kind of equating that to the fact of being, having that happen at an early age. I should have been, really frightened of any kind of heat or flame.
Right.
And I was completely the opposite. I was, as I kind of mentioned, if it wasn't that I became a chef, I might have become a pyromaniac because I was always fascinated by fire.
How did you remember all these incidents that are in the memoir part of this book? It seems like you must have been taking notes.
Yeah, but, on your life.
But surely for the first several years, you really couldn't write it down.
Well, anything that, it seems that anything having to do with food in my life, and being brought up, and especially the grocery store, because it made such a, because I spent so much time living down there. It's kind of as clear to me as, really as a baseball player remembering a pitch count 10 years before, that where he was facing a pitcher and he was pitching, you know, the first pitch came in and it was outside, the second one was a curve, the third was a slider. That's the kind of memory I have for food and for food-related topics. And, you know, and at times, because I've been writing a column for the paper for the Milwaukee Journal for close to 14 years now, and, you know, a lot of times these stories are so vibrant in my mind, even from when I was, you know, 7, 8 years old. And I wrote a story about when I got my first paper out for the Milwaukee Sentinel.
And
I think I was around 7 or 8 at that time. And I was describing this Ronnie and Rolly, who were the captains of the paper, and with these cool tools that they had, you know, for cutting wire cutters and all this stuff, and I was really fascinated by that. Well, it turned out that about a year ago, there was a knock on the door at the restaurant, and he came downstairs, and there was this fellow and his wife. They were dressed in traditional German garb, like lederhosen and dirndl, and he looks at me and he says, "Do you remember me?" And I said, "I'm not sure." And he hands me the wire cutter, and it was Ronnie, captain from, you know, and that was 55 years ago. And he was telling me that his brother Rolly had passed away, and he had read the story in the paper, and he was so flattered that he remembered going out in the morning for, you know, because eating these huge breakfasts. So it's just something that I've always had a great memory for.
Well, this is a wonderful storybook.
Yes.
But let's not forget, it also represents an assemblage of presumably the favorite recipes that you've accumulated over how many decades in cooking?
It's been 46 years, 46, 47 years since I started. The whole crux of the book for me is that without the stories, there are no recipes.
Right.
That's where food comes from, and that's what I feel all good food comes from. That all good food comes from a story, because there's a lot of food out there that people will, you know, they'll find recipes on the internet, and then, you know, and then make up a recipe and do this, because you can really find anything you want.
Right.
You can find the way the food, how the food's prepared, what it looks like, how to set it up. But the thing that's missing when people do that is the real integrity and the soul of the food. They really become recipes can be soulless frames if they don't have the story and the feeling and the taste memories behind them.
Well, you have wonderful stories to tell. I mean, part of your introduction, you talk about how you never felt confident as a writer until it was pointed out to you that you're a wonderful storyteller, and that's what it's about. And, of course, you just said your recipes are stories. We could talk about individual stories for a long time, starting with, you said that you were afraid to tell your parents that you wanted to be a chef.
Well, yeah, I had started cooking. It was my last year of high school. I was 17. I had been going to it was a Jesuit college preparatory school, Marquette High School in Milwaukee, and expected to go to college. And I was working with my dad in the store one day, and I just said, "How would you feel if I got into cooking? If I wanted to cook?" And you know, he looked at me and he said, "I'd be happy you doing anything you want to do. There's only one thing you cannot do." He said, "You cannot be in this grocery store."
Uh-huh.
He said, "You can do anything else in life." He said, "I just want you to be happy, but you cannot be in this grocery store." Because he always wanted to, during the war, he was a machinist in California. And he had always, originally he wanted to be a dentist, but there was no money at that time for him even to go to college, because he was the first son and he had to work in the store. And, mm-hmm. and then my grandfather called him back in the 50s from Los Angeles, and so my parents had to move back to Milwaukee. And he always, there was a part of him that resented that. And he never wanted me to be in the store. And so we talked about it afterwards. We thought it was kind of ironic that where Angie and I ended up was at Sanford Restaurant, which was the grocery store.
Exactly.
We ended up, it was just another mom-and-pop place.
You, of course, you, I mean, between when you were graduating from high school and when you were opening your restaurant, you attended the most prestigious culinary school in the country, the CIA.
And right.
So, now, you did work in some really important restaurants. Where does it fit in that you went back to Milwaukee and opened Sanford?
Well, it was about, I was in America, it was about 1978. And I was working at the Chantilly at that time, which had just opened up. And it was considered at that time, it was written up as one of the three best French restaurants in the country at that time. And I was doing really well there, and I was a poissonnier, and I was learning what I wanted to learn. But my personal life, I didn't have any balance in life. And I was talking with the pastry chef there, Dieter Schorner, who's actually an instructor at the Culinary Institute. And I used to work with him every Saturday learning pastries, because that was I worked 6 days, and that was my only morning off was Saturday morning. And as he was showing me things, I'd tell him a lot about my personal life too, you know, and he said, most of the people here that are really successful in this city give up a lot in their personal life. He said, you have to decide what's important to you. And he said, New York might not be the place for you if you want to find that balance that you're talking about. And so that's how I ended up moving out to Long Island for a year. And when I was out there on the off-season in Long Island, on-season in Long Island, it's just like being in Manhattan, except people are really mad because they have to wait longer for their food and they're on vacation. But in the off-season, as soon as Labor Day would roll around, it was at that time in the 70s, it was you and the potato farmers. And so it was a different pace of life, and it reminded me of what I missed about Milwaukee. And I thought at that time I wanted to open up a restaurant at some time, and I wanted to have this balance in life. And it made sense to me that I knew I'd never own a restaurant in New York because I would never have the money.
Right.
I might have, you know, 2 or 3% of a restaurant or something, but I'd never really own it. And I felt that my best chance would be in Milwaukee to do that.
Now, what did you expect the people would think? I mean, they were not prepared for your food.
Well, you know, I went back, and there was a good fine dining vibe going on in Milwaukee at that time.
Okay.
I mean, it wasn't New York, and it wasn't a major city like that. But there was good food there. And the only difference with a lot of places at that time was that the coast really didn't recognize that there was good food anywhere else. I mean, there was good food all around the country, in you know, like in small spots. But you would never, even in Chicago, they'd never got the kind of press that you get if you were in New York San Francisco.
I just read that Chicago is petitioning the James Beard Foundation to move the annual awards to Chicago.
Oh, really?
Yeah, well, it's like any other convention, I suppose.
And it is one of the greatest food cities in the country right now.
Oh, yeah. Well, there are lots of them. That's, I guess, one of the big changes that we've seen. We were going to talk about that later on. I wanted to make sure we got in two things. Well, one of the things I thought was hysterical was that you went all over Wisconsin in the Weenie Mobile with Julia Child.
Oh, yeah. Well, that came about from she was coming. We had started a chapter of American Institute of Wine and Food, AIWF, at that time. And she was coming out for the inaugural dinner, and then which we were going to have at Sanford. I was one of the founders of the chapter. And then we took her around the state for for 3 days, I think it was. And, you know, we were doing the normal things you do in Wisconsin. You're taking her to cheese purveyors and to a Beale Farm and everything, you know, kind of showing off Wisconsin mm-hmm. dairy products. And so on the way back from Provini Via, they had the private jet to take us back to the Waukesha County Airport where we had drove to, and then we were going to drive back to Milwaukee from there. And as we were flying into the airport, I looked out the window, and I Gabriel, who was Julia's aide, looked out and she said, Sandy, she said, what is that? And I looked out and I said, oh my God, I said, that's a Wienermobile. Is it the Wienermobile to pick us up? And she said, I don't think so. And I was really disappointed because I really wanted to ride in the Wienermobile. And Julia looked out the window and she said, I think I'd like to ride in that Wiener bus. And then so transpired as surreal a time as I've ever had, riding down I-94 with Julia Child in the Wienermobile.
That's funny.
with the theme song in the background.
Oh, yes. I mean, I know the Wienerman real well. Now, the other thing I didn't want I wanted to include for sure is that you were one of 12 chefs invited to cook for Julia for her 80th birthday. Now, that must have been a thrill.
Yeah, it was quite unexpected when it happened, but it was we were on vacation in Virgin Gorda. We had decided after we were open our first year that the only way we were ever going to get away, because we worked every day we were open, was that we would close. So we decided that because our staff was so small and we couldn't let people go on vacation, we just closed for the week. Mm-hmm. And so we planned this trip to Virgin Gorda, and we had told people before we left, family and everything, that we're going to be somewhere, there's going to be no phone, no TV, nothing. We said, don't call unless if it's an emergency or something's really bad. So I got this, someone came down from the desk and they said there was a phone call for me. And I was really nervous because I thought, you know, like, somebody's sick or something's wrong. There was a friend who called up and said, I know you didn't want any phone calls, but I thought you'd like to know that Julia Child called, and she said she wanted that Andy boy from Milwaukee to cook for her birthday, and Andy was close enough to Sandy, so I was thrilled.
Tell us about the cannoli that you made, because that's one of the really interesting recipes. That's totally made.
Yeah, it's a ginger snap cannoli, and the dinner was for 650 of her closest friends.
Oh yeah,
at the Copley Plaza. It was put on by WGBH.
Uh-huh.
And they had it. They did a show on it. It was Salute to the Chef, or Salute to Julia Child's 80th birthday. And the cannoli that I did, we were each doing, there were three people. It was Marcel Desaulniers, who was doing his Death by Chocolate cake, and then Joanne and George Killian and Joanne Germain from
Germain
and Joanne Killian from El Forno.
Right, right.
And they were doing their tiramisu. So there were three desserts on a plate. All the chefs, there were three people, like, working on each course, two to three people. And so you were sharing the plate. And so Joanne was cutting the tiramisu when we were setting up, and she put this on the plate. And Marcel looks over at me, and he said, well, he said, Joanne, should we leave? And she said, what? She said, do you think it's too big? And it was covering three-quarters of the plate. And we said, we're putting three desserts on here. Well, this is like half of what we serve at the restaurant. So we cut it down. Everybody, you know, we put our little desserts on there. But, yeah, the ginger snap cannoli was something that Julia had requested because she had had it at Sanford when she had dined there. And that was a dish that I originally made when we opened the restaurant that I felt, because when we changed, my father closed the grocery store, and then we demoed the space, built the restaurant, and then opened up. So it was a perfect transition from a Sicilian grocery store to Sanford. And it really encompassed kind of what we were doing with food at the time, that it was an ode to a cannoli. It wasn't a traditional Sicilian cannoli.
Right. That's for sure, yeah.
But I had my uncle came in, who was very traditional, and when he had the cannoli, he said, you know, Sandy, he said, that's not a cannoli. And I said, I said, I know that. He said, but it's one of the best things I've ever had.
Oh, that's great.
And, you know, so, and, cause, but it, it's what we did with food. That was kind of the,
I can't miss the one story I caught when you found out that you finally got the loan to open the restaurant. Was it your father or your grandfather who already had the sledgehammer in his hand to start knocking out the wall?
We went through 13 banks until we finally found a banker that looked at both Angie and I as a team. Everyone else was looking at me. I had a good reputation in the city at that time as a chef, but everyone was saying, well, do you know how to manage a restaurant, how to run a restaurant? And I said, well, my wife is a manager. And nobody looked at both of us except our 13th banker, who was a woman, and the only one that was. And she said, you know, if you guys aren't going to make it, she said, who is? And that's how we got the loan. And we were looking, when we got the call, my father was standing behind us, and he disappeared. And then we heard this big crash in the back. And I went back there, and he had a sledgehammer, and he was breaking through the back wall. And he said, I've been waiting a long time for this. It was really him getting out all his aggression of the years of being in the store and not wanting to be there. And he was just waiting for that change.
Well, this is a gem. This is a lovely story.
And it's one of many in this book, along with some really luscious recipes, which we didn't touch on nearly long enough, because there are just fabulous recipes in this book as well. And I think you have all the information about your cooking school online.
And also people can get cookbooks there if they do. I mean, you can get them through Amazon too, but if anybody would like a personalized signed cookbook, you can get it through the website.
But check on goodstockfarm.com, which is your website, and get all the information, how the farm's doing, how the courses are shaping up, and more of your stories.
This is a masterpiece of understatement. Life on a low simmer. I don't think so. I don't think that quite tells the story of what's between the front page and the back page.
Thank you.
Regardless, it's a wonderful story that you obviously have enjoyed every minute of. And the good news is it's not over. So you're going to have to write some more chapters, I'm sure. And thank
you. Yeah, well, the cooking school will bring us into hopefully the next 40-some years. If that lasts that long.
Thank you for joining us today, and keep up the great work.
Sandy.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you for the wonderful question.
And if you think that these two family stories are interesting, wait till you hear the one right after the break about a family that's been in the same business for five generations.
I hate to admit that I have been gorging on a very fine chocolate, but I will admit it, and we're going to be talking to, you say, you are the fifth generation in this chocolate family, and Valeriano Lopez from Alicante, España. Valeriano, you were explaining how chocolate even got to, your family's been in this a long time. When the chocolate was brought back from South America by the Spanish, it was just drinking cocoa, isn't it?
Yeah, well, that's 5 centuries ago. That's a while ago. But, yeah, well, actually, this guy, Monk Aguilar, went to Yucatan, to the peninsula of Yucatan, over there in Mexico, with Hernán Cortés, and he brought back some cocoa beans. He found that Aztecs and Mayans used the cocoa beans even as a currency for them. They would be paying other goods with this cocoa bean, and they would prepare it a drink they would drink it to walk all day through the jungle or whatever. It was a very energetic drink. Okay, it would give them a lot of energy to work and to do whatever. It was very, very appreciated for them, and he took some to Spain. It was a very bitter and even spicy, because they used to mix it with spices, with chili and many other things, but not sugar. And he brought these cocoa beans to his monastery in Zaragoza, the Monasterio de la Piedra in Zaragoza. It's a very famous monastery in Spain. And the monks there tried different formulas until they get it. They mixed it actually with sugar and cinnamon at that time, and that was a drink. It was the hot chocolate drink. So that was the first recipe of sweet or candy chocolate at the time.
Right.
That was 400 or 500 years ago, a while ago.
They
kept the recipes as a secret for over a century, and well, it became very popular on the on the wealthy families, right? Because it was very, So it became very popular in whole Europe. I mean, it went to the rest of the countries in Europe, and basically that's the very start of the story. So chocolate used to be a drink, just a drink, not a bar. Nowadays we eat more bars than drink chocolate, but in general, the world consumption of us is much bigger than drinking chocolate. But still, there's a remaining drinking chocolate consumption.
Right.
Big time.
But there are these bars, and in your area, you said that one time there were 30 different families involved in companies involved in producing chocolate candy, and now it's gone down to 3, and your family is one of them, huh?
Yeah, well, basically, on the 40s, 1940s, 1950s, there used to be like 30 to 40 chocolate factories. They were small family business selling regionally, I would say, like locally in the, let's say, the 400 kilometers or 200, 300 miles around the town. the village. Half of the economy of the village was based on the chocolate and the agriculture. The other half of the economy was based on fisheries, because it's in the coast of Spain. The town is Villajoyosa. It's a small village right there in front of the Mediterranean coast with nice beaches and great weather, I have to say, too. Nowadays, we remain three companies. We are the biggest, and, well, we basically did the right thing in the right moment, and we had the capability and the knowledge and the way to accommodate to the new trends of the chocolate business in Spain, with the, you know, with the mass consumption, with the big chains of stores, you know, the modern distribution and everything. And we built a brand there with a big effort on quality standards and philosophy of production. We did what nobody was doing on the 60s and 70s, let's say, doing pure chocolate with high content of cocoa beans, with a very important concern from us about the origins of the cocoa beans and about using only cocoa beans, about the origins of the nuts that we're using. We're using only Marcona almonds in our chocolate.
Yes, we've tasted those. Those are winners.
Yeah, exactly.
And hazelnuts, yeah. Those are winners too.
No.
Yeah, we do use very special hazelnut too. Growth in Spain only. I mean, we only use nuts growth in Spain. The cocoa beans cannot grow in Spain. But we only consume Ghana, Ecuador, and Panama. These three origins. It's very important to keep the same origins. So we mix them, we blend them in the same proportion all the time. The proportions are secret, I have to say.
Oh, that's
not even me know the proportions yet. but we use these three origins all the time, so we keep the same taste, same flavor. We waste like 20% of the cocoa beans that we receive due to the cleaning system, the cleaning procedure, and the quality standards that we are requiring to our suppliers. So we actually have a lose in that section of a 20%, but it's our philosophy to keep it, because the main thing is to keep the bouquet of the chocolate and the the final taste and quality of it.
Valeriano,
the whole process.
Valeriano, how did the chocolate making come to move to Alicante? I mean, you said the original monastery where they developed it was in Saragossa, which is quite far north. Alicante is quite a different climate. I mean, what was there some particular event that caused that to happen?
Well, basically, about Saragossa, that was 500 years ago.
I don't know
where my family was at that time, actually. Our company is 135 years old. It's fifth generation running it. Actually, there's no real consensus history about this There are several theories. There's a theory that an Italian came to the village, to the small village, with some cocoa beans to teach people. There's another that says the fisherman's fishing in Africa would bring cocoa beans on their boats coming back. It's a fisherman's town, so there was a big fishery industry in this little town. There was some big companies based on in here serving to the whole country. And they used to fish in Africa, so they would bring, it's a theory, they would bring these cocoa beans in the boats when they would come back home to, you know, to have some weight in the boat to make it feel better. And they would try this cocoa beans that they would take. I mean, at that time, communications was not that good, and nobody's in town is really sure about what happened.
Yeah.
The thing is, early 20th century, late 19th century, there were a bunch of families producing chocolate locally, very small businesses, like very family-oriented, normally farmers that used to grow oranges, and they would have this as a side business to increase their income. But then in the 40s, there were like 35 little companies making chocolate, and now we're just three, but basically it's one, because we are leaders in Spain, basically.
We have a similar mystery, because we actually live in southwestern Pennsylvania, and Pennsylvania itself is, for some reason, it's a huge chocolate-making state. And in fact, in southwestern Pennsylvania, all these chocolate companies are owned by Greeks.
Wow.
And nobody knows anything about that either. Now, how did you get the name of your company, Valor?
Well, the name basically is a nickname, actually. It sounds like a last name.
Yeah.
But it was my great-great-grandfather, whose name was Valeriano López, but his fans used to call him Valor. For some reason, maybe to make it shorter and easier. It's a nickname, basically.
So you were named after him?
Yeah, actually, my friends call me Valor, too.
Well, I suppose they would.
Yeah, but it's basically, it's a nickname. So the chocolate has our nickname.
You know what it means in English?
Valor.
It means bravery.
Yeah, I know. Well,
so you must be a really tough guy.
a tough guy
with a soft spot for making chocolate bars.
Yeah. Same meaning in Spanish, I gotta say.
What is your biggest market? The States, Europe, where?
Well, but our main market is Spain, I have to say. The national market in Spain, that's like 75-80% of our sales. Mm-hmm. Second market in export, it's U.S., and, well, basically we have Canada, we have South America, is a very good market for us, and now we are launching, well, we have some good markets also in Asia, like China, Philippines, several markets. So we are already in 50 countries right
but
now.
The competition is so enormous in chocolate. I mean, what do you do with all this trendy stuff, like with the chili-flavored things and all that?
Well, we do. We try our best at launching new flavors and exciting flavors every once in a while. It's not easy because, well, these guys are super big. These are multinationals. They are not family business. They are several thousand million dollar companies. And, well, we are a very small company. We made the store in Spain. We are fighting with them in Spain as well. Our main competitors in Spain are locally, but are Nestle, Lindt, Kraft, Milka, these big players. We are fighting with them locally in Spain. We are the second in Spain in terms of market share, right after Nestle, but we have an SKU that's our best seller. It's around the €3. It's 8.75 bars. It's the big bar with almonds. That's our best seller in Spain.
Mm-hmm.
And it's 8.75, €3 a unit. And Nestlé has a bar of around the 3 ounces and 80 cents a bar, 80 cents of euro a bar. So we compete with these big guys, but we have a really big brand recognition earned by the years with the quality and doing the best things always. I mean, as always, we've been doing. And we're there, and we're still there.
Yeah.
You know, fighting and working hard, because it's not easy, but still, it's our north, I would say. It's our target.
Yeah, and what is your website? You have all the interesting...
Sure, very easy. www.valor.es. E as in Edward, S as in Sam. That's like España.
Yeah.
So it's not .com, it's .es. There you can find the whole range. There's a virtual visit of the factory where we explain with videos and images how we do the chocolate, so you can see the inside of the chocolate. By the way, talking about the factory, I have to say we have a very nice museum in the factory. We have 70,000 visitors every year.
Okay.
And there's a tour that you can visit the museum, watch a video explaining the history about the chocolate a little bit and the whole process, and then you go visit the real factory. We show it very proudly. People who visit the factory get hop to our brand immediately because they see in person with their own eyes how we do things there, and that's the best. I have to say that's the best publicity that we have. So we show our facilities to everybody who wants to see them because we're super proud, and we know that it's the best way to advertise our products.
We had a lovely visit in Alicante. Obviously, visiting your chocolate factory was about the only thing we missed out.
I'm sure. And you missed a big thing. Actually, we are the second museum most visited in the province, in Alicante.
Okay. We did go to a museum for the big parade. It's not called the Fala in Valencia. It's called something different in Alicante.
Oredas.
Yeah, and we we actually saw the parade of the niños, the children.
Yeah.
We watched that whole procession, and I have lots of photographs of it.
Yeah,
really.
Yeah,
very
nice. We had a good time. Anyhow, well, next trip we'll definitely pick up a tour of your museum and your factory.
And thank you so much for taking the time to call us all this way.
Oh, absolutely, it's my pleasure. And if any time you come to Spain next time, let me know, and I will organize a visit to the factory. It's really interesting. Well, visiting a factory in general, normally it's interesting, but visiting a chocolate factory has something special, you know. For some reason, chocolate is a really friendly product in general. Everybody likes chocolate. So
I think you're right.
Good.
I think you're right. I think you're in the right business. You have a tremendous attitude. You have tremendous pride in your family. I think that's just great. And so I'm glad to hear that out of the 30 or 40 of there, you're the one that's left leading the pack. Well done.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Hasta luego, Valenciano.
We hope you found these happy family stories to be just as entertaining and interesting as we did, and that your family is as happy as our family, and that you'll join us again, same time, same place next week. And until then, bye-bye.